I'm Erica, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 2nd of 1995, and my home group is Step by Step in Lafayette, Louisiana, and I'm very grateful to be here. I know you guys have worked really hard. I don't know how many of you realize, but this is the first RIVCPAW. This conference committee started with an idea and a meeting, and they passed a basket, and that's how this conference got off the ground, and that's amazing, you know? Another thing I wanted to say before I begin with my story is, I don't know how many of you were here this morning for Janet's workshop on relationships, but it was so neat. I was thinking I could listen to that tape every day and go through each relationship that I have, whether it's the relationship I'm in or family or sponsees or whatever, and look at, you know, is it through God or is it through me? And I could take an inventory of my relationships and use that every single day. Everything that she said, it's like I listened and it kept me accountable. You know, it got me thinking, how do I act in my relationships? It was amazing. I really, really, really enjoyed it. When I was walking in this morning, John said, are you giving a workshop on relationships? Because I had my big book and I was like, no, not me. It was pretty funny. And you could just tell that she lives it. You know, you could tell that she uses those things. It's one thing to get up here and talk about everything that she said this morning about relationships, but you could really tell that she lives it, you know. So I want to say that everything that I'm going to say today is my experience or opinion, and that I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is, you know, I'm not, this is not the law. And I say that because being up here is a real opportunity to mold newcomers' ideas. I know that I went to a lot of conventions. I had a sponsor who brought me every month we went to a convention, and I would listen and I would just be like, yeah, that's awesome, you know. And if I hadn't been in a step study, if I hadn't had a sponsor that took me through the big book, I might have believed some things that weren't necessarily true, you know. And we're all human, and I get nervous up here, and I can say something that might not necessarily be in the big book if I'm not careful, you know, or misquote something. And so I just want to say that this is all just my experience. And if you are unsure about something, refer back to the big book, you know. I'm just going to stick with my experience and the steps. I don't want to get into all the other controversial topics that a speaker could get into, like therapy or medication or anything like that. So that's it. All right, so I'll tell you where I began. I grew up in a family that didn't have a lot of money at all. At least to me, we definitely didn't have a lot of money. My grandmother sent my sister and I to a private school, and so compared to those kids, I felt like we were bottom of the rung. Now, we had a home to live in. You know, some guy said, you were dirt poor. I said I was dirt poor once. You were dirt poor. Did your house have a foundation? You know, and it was like, yes, I had a home to live in. I had clothes. We had food. But I went to this private school, and my grandmother thought that it would be a good idea to save money. She would make our uniforms rather than buy the uniforms that all the other students had. And they didn't look the same. So I was, you know, wearing uniforms that supposedly made us all blend in together, and I stood out in line, you know. So I felt different. I felt different from the very beginning. I did not like school. It was such a, what's the word? it took so much energy for me to show up, even in kindergarten. I can remember I didn't want to go and talk to anybody. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to have to interact. I was so nervous and insecure, and I just, I felt like they all knew that my dad and my mom fought and that they were going through a divorce. That my parents got divorced when I was in kindergarten or almost in first grade, and I just thought they all knew that, and I didn't like going from the very beginning. And honestly, those feelings of insecurity never went away until after I got sober. It was suppressed, definitely, when I started drinking. I mean, that's why it worked so well, you know. My parents got divorced. It wasn't a real big change. My dad worked offshore, so I only saw him every other week. And so I didn't really have, you know, a big, hard time transitioning with that. And I just, you know, lived a normal little child's life, I guess. When I was 10, well, my dad got sober when I was 6 in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, he did not work the steps. So I don't know if any of you have done that, gotten, you know, sobered up and not worked the steps, but sometimes it's worse, you know, being in the program and without a solution, just not drinking. And so I would go to meetings with him, but I just didn't understand what everyone's problem was, you know. I thought that the people sitting around the room needed to just stop whining, stop drinking, and get a life. And I remember as like an 8 or 9-year-old, I thought, oh, if I could just say something, if I could just tell them, you know, quit your whining. Go and get a life. Don't sit in here. And I did not understand that there was other stuff going on than just fellowship. You know, we went to meetings at a clubhouse, and we hung out there a lot of the time, and it was better than sitting at home watching TV, and my sister and I enjoyed going, but I never really understood what it was all about. And having a sober dad, it really just made me want to drink. I wanted to find out what it was all about. I was curious. No one ever said don't drink, but it was definitely, you look at what alcohol did to dad. And so I wanted to drink all the more. And when I was 10, I started experimenting. We actually did have some alcohol in our house that no one knew was there. I think it was way up in the cabinet where nobody went. And I found it and I drank it. And I didn't get drunk that time. But the first time that I got drunk, I was with a few friends. It was 7:00 in the morning. I lied, left the house of a friend of mine. They drank screwdrivers, and I thought, why waste all of this vodka on orange juice? Just give me the vodka, you know? And so I drank, and there was like 3 of us. I threw up, I blacked out, and came to back at my friend's house in her bed, and I had made a fool of myself. I had gotten in trouble, and I thought, you know, through all of that, I thought, this was so awesome. I just want to do it again. I just, you know, I could laugh. I made them laugh. I wasn't insecure. I wasn't, you know, just sitting there reserved and quiet. I was, you know, I was able to be myself, and I liked that person. And from there, I pretty much tried to get drunk every chance after that. Quickly, I found friends who didn't mind me drinking or taking their parents' liquor. And I wanted that feeling. I mean, really, when I got drunk the first time, I thought, God, I wish I had found this sooner, you know? This is great. And I loved it, and I wanted to drink every chance I could after that. I left that private school in the middle of 8th grade because those kids just, I kind of became the black sheep, you know, me and another girl, and we both left and went to public schools, and ended up hanging out with some people that weren't in school, hadn't been in school, few of them didn't have a place to live. And my dad bought cigarettes for my sister and I. He thought, don't waste your money on cigarettes. I mean, if you're going to smoke, let me buy them. And so we got a carton of cigarettes, you know, every week or 2 weeks. And so I would give them cigarettes, get alcohol, give some of the guys food, and steal money for my mom. She started going to Al-Anon in 1984, and denial is, it will destroy a family. She fired more than one housekeeper because they would not stop taking her money. You know? They just would not stop taking her money. But her kid would show up drunk, and I was too young to work, and I didn't have that big of an allowance, you know? Put it together. And she would say, I think, you know, whoever is taking money from me, and I would say, oh, I think so, you know? There was not a lot of stability. You know, my mom isn't stupid. She has a master's degree. She's a teacher, and she's a really tough teacher. I've been to work with her. But they say that our home is the hardest place to practice the steps, and it's true. We walked all over her, you know. Many nights I would leave in the middle of the night, and she would call the police, and then I would call her drunk, not knowing how to get home. And she would call the police and say, it's okay, I found her. And I would go and pass out, and we would never talk about it. When I was 13, I sobered up for a few months. I didn't really sober up. I went to meetings. My dad thought I was sober, and he would give me a chip every month and make a big speech, and I would share something, which God only knows what I said. And this is the really crazy thing. I was going to this specific meeting because there was a group of a halfway house of guys that went. And I was not in AA, and I was not, I mean, I was claiming to be in AA, but I wasn't. And I wasn't in a halfway house or treatment or anything, and I showed up at an AA meeting to pick up guys that were in treatment, you know? But I was 13, and I had them all to myself. You know, there weren't any other 13-year-olds in the room, and so I had a lot of attention, and that's pretty much how it went. I went through friends really fast. If you like to drink the way that I like to drink, or you didn't complain about my drinking, then I hung out with you. And if you did complain about my drinking, then I didn't even think twice. I just didn't have time for it. And relationships weren't that important. I mean, I got sober right before I turned 15, and it really, I wasn't even worried about that. I definitely used the fact that I was a woman to get what I wanted. Not a woman, I mean, I was a girl, but I was female. And I use the fact that I'm female, and I use that to get alcohol. I didn't get into a lot of drugs. Alcohol did it for me, you know. I think that had I been exposed to more drugs, I definitely would have done them, because once I got drunk, I pretty much did whatever you offered me. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough not to be exposed to a lot. The guys that I was drinking with started smoking crack shortly after I sobered up, and I'm very grateful that I just missed that, like within months, because I know that I would have been open, you know, to trying anything, and most of them are in jail now. And so I had a lot of run-ins with the police. I went to treatment, left treatment, thought, I will never drink again. This is horrible. I don't want to be locked up in a place like this where I can't smoke. You know, I thought, this is just horrible. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I didn't really learn a whole lot. The next morning, I was drunk again because I left there saying I wasn't ever going to drink again, but I didn't know how I was never going to drink again, you know. I just knew I didn't want to get locked up. And so from there, I went to stay with some friends and two girls that didn't make it out of junior high. And their parents drank, and we drank all together for the next few months. and it was a really horrible situation. We were all just very intoxicated. We drank all night, slept all day, and didn't really come into contact with many people. The woman was a nurse, and my mom's denial was just so bad. She would call my mom and say, "I'm sorry she didn't make it to school again. She's still sick." And my mom would say, "Okay," and just had no idea really of what was going on. And I think that inside she knew, obviously, I wasn't willing to come home ever. But that's, it's just, this disease affects our entire family. Christmas, I got sober on January 2nd. That Christmas, right before, I did go with my mom and my sister to see our family, told a series of lies, got very, very, very drunk, and I woke up the next morning. I had vomit all over me. I was on the floor, and I couldn't remember what had happened. I did remember later. I threw up in this poor girl's car that she had gotten for Christmas that day, and I was with my cousins, and I threw up in that pocket, where you can just not ever get all the way down in there. But I was with my cousins who were good kids, and they were a little bit older than me, and then my younger sister and the younger cousins, and I don't know how I managed to get so drunk, because the thing was is we had to keep lying, and we left for a movie after lunch, and we went home in the middle of the night, and we just kept lying, saying, "Oh, we missed the movie, we missed the movie, we missed the movie," and they kept telling more lies, and I kept getting more drunk, and it wasn't by any means the worst experience I had ever had, but when I woke up and I couldn't remember what had happened, and then there was like, instead of, two people giving me the silent treatment, there was like 10 people giving me the silent treatment. And I remember I took a shower and I went inside in the car until it was time to go, because I just didn't want to face them. And my mom said, "This has got to stop." And she started looking for a treatment center. We couldn't use insurance anymore because I had already been to treatment on it. And so she started looking for a place. And in the meantime, I said, "Well, screw it. I guess I'll go to treatment." I wanted help, but I didn't really want to get sober. But I didn't want to drink. And I just was in that place where something had to give. But I did not want to get sober. I did not want to have to face people and face all the stuff that I had been doing for the last few years, and all the lies and all the, just screwing up. And I felt like I had started so young. What kind of life was I going to have if I sobered up? I had started to ruin my life before my life really got started. And so I wanted to die, but I didn't really want to die, and I didn't know what I wanted. And so I kept drinking, and she started looking for a treatment center and found one. And I mean, the last week I drank, I just drank like always. And she found a place for me on the 5th. And after New Year's, on the 2nd, I guess everyone knew I was going to treatment. I couldn't get anybody to come and get me from my house. And I didn't have any money. I had taken cabs many times in the middle of the night, but I would always get someone there to pay for the cab. And I didn't have any money. No one would come and get me. And I couldn't find anyone to buy me any alcohol. And so I was just stuck. And I was stuck at home with, I felt like no one there for me, and no alcohol and nowhere to go. And so my head kind of started to clear up, and it was like, it was, I just saw a picture of all the things I had been doing and the people I'd been using and the lies, and I definitely did not want to get sober after that. Like a few days of not drinking, and I didn't want to go to treatment. But I went, and I wasn't very open-minded, but I was very scared. There were girls in this place. I went to State Grounds in Pineville, State, whatever it is, State Hospital, the Adolescent Treatment Center there, and there were girls there that had had a much tougher life than me. A few wards of the state, and girls my age that had children already, and, you know, I thought that I had done, I thought that I had had a hard life, you know, and they looked at me as a snobby little white 14-year-old, you know, and I looked at them as being unlucky. I don't know what I thought. I just didn't want to be sober. I stayed in the treatment center, and I followed the rules, and I kind of reverted back to that kid that I was before I found alcohol, only I had the F's, you know. I was like, F you, F you, F you, I don't want to be here, I don't want to get sober, leave me alone, you know, my life's working fine. And somewhere with my attitude of not caring, you know, if you sit in a place long enough and enough people start to open up and other people care, and, you know, the doors were locked, I couldn't go anywhere, and I wasn't an adult, so I couldn't leave on my own will. I guess I started to open up a little bit. Not a lot changed there, except my mom. She went back to Al-Anon, and she came to visit me and said that I was going to a halfway house, and I was like, no, I'm not going to a halfway house. I don't want to go to a halfway house, and, you know, 6 weeks is long enough. And she said, no, you're going to halfway house. And I started crying because I could always get her to change her mind. And I could always manipulate her, you know, just if I didn't give up, eventually she would break. And she said, you can cry or you can enjoy my visit, but if you don't stop crying, then I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go back to Lafayette, and we won't visit today, but you're going to halfway house. And I was like, wow, you know, I guess, like, I didn't want her to leave. I mean, she was, even though I didn't like her very much, I was glad that she came to visit me, you know. And so I just, you know, I was really shocked. I was really surprised. And I guess I had a few more weeks left. Somewhere in there, I just got over the idea that I was going to a halfway house. By the end of leaving there, I found out that you could smoke inside the halfway house. The doors weren't locked. And so I got really excited, you know. I was like, as long as I can smoke, it's okay. You know, it'll be all right, as long as I can smoke. And I went, and I came up here and went to an adolescent halfway house in Shreveport. And I'm sure that halfway house has changed a lot, but what it was like when I was there was it revolved around Alcoholics Anonymous. We were required to read the big book. We went to a meeting every day. There were a lot of rules, of course, because we were all minors, you know. They said that we could smoke, and that was very, very important to me. But we did. We had to. I guess you didn't have to, but we were asked to read the big book. Eventually, we had to find a sponsor to give our inventory to. Things like that were required of us. And we had also two young women that came and did a step study with us every week. And they were, you know, two women from the AA community. And so when I got there, I was still kind of had a bad attitude. I didn't really want to do anything. And for a few, I guess about 2 months, I didn't do anything. And I wasn't getting it, you know. I wasn't getting this sobriety thing. I wasn't feeling better. I definitely didn't have a pink cloud, as people call it. I just was kind of hard-headed, and I would do what the girls wanted me to do because, damn it, I wanted their approval, but I just didn't want to do what the counselors were asking me to do, or, you know, the whatever they were, directors. And one day, step one happened. I mean, it was an event in my sobriety. I realized that I was miserable drinking, and I was miserable sober, and I could keep doing things the way that I wanted to do them, or I could try what these people were suggesting, because nobody was making me stay sober. But I could go and drink, you know. I could BS my way through the halfway house. I could go home and I could drink again, and I would probably end up wanting to die again. Or I could try what these women were asking me to do and give sobriety a shot. And something changed when that thought, you know, finally occurred in my head. Something really changed. I realized that nobody was forcing me to stay sober, you know? That, yes, I was in this facility, but nobody was really making me, I could leave, you know, and I could drink, and that, you know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous weren't there because it was more miserable being sober, you know, they weren't there because it sucked so bad, you know, they hadn't stopped drinking and started working the steps because they hated, you know, they hated it all so much, or because it didn't work. They were there because they really were happier. They weren't lying. And seriously, step one, it was like I was just kind of there, dragging my feet. And then that occurred. And step one, two, and three kind of all came at the same time. Once I surrendered, I mean, I really just kind of gave up. And you know, I knew that I believed in a higher power. And I think that any hope that I had at that time came from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I saw working the steps, and it was working for them. You know, I did believe in God, but any hope that I really got came from other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Another thing was, so many mornings that I woke up and I wasn't hungover, and I was in my bed, you know. I wasn't on someone's floor. I wasn't just confused about where I was. I used to lay there when I would come to, and I would start thinking about what had happened the day before and whose boyfriend I had messed around with and how I was going to call all these girls and explain to them what was going on, give them a rundown. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't at fault. It wasn't my fault. Start placing the blame, you know, getting everything together, you know, and I would lay there in bed and think about all these lies that I need to pull together, and it was just too overwhelming, and I just assumed drink, you know? And that was how my mornings were, or afternoons, or whenever I woke up. And so I've been, you know, dry, waking up not feeling that way, and my head was clearing, and I saw these other people that had something going for them that I didn't have going for me. And so when the point of surrender came, it kind of came with one, two, and three. And they asked me to write an inventory, and I just wouldn't do it. I was given the directions for the fourth step, and I started to remember all these things that I had done, sober and drinking, you know. Just things, ways that I had treated people, and there was one thing that when I remembered it, I was like, I am never going to write this fourth step. I'm just not going to do it, you know, and I would sit down to write, and I would cry, and I just could not imagine telling someone this one thing that I had done. And I opened the big book one day, and it was in Into Action, and it was talking about the fifth step, but I knew that in order to get to the fifth step, you had to write the fourth step. And it said that, I'll read it to you. It really got my butt into action. It says, this is perhaps difficult. It's talking about the fifth step. especially discussing our defects with another person. It says we will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason for us, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And you know when, I mean, there are lots of times that I'm reading this and I'm like, oh, I never noticed that was there. But I had really never read this part before ever. And I was like, whoa, I'm not the only person that doesn't want to skip this step, you know? I'm not the only person that just thinks that this is horrible. And so I cried and I wrote my inventory. Not only that, I had also been bribed. The whole halfway house was going to this lake house for the weekend. And my counselor was like, if you don't do your fourth step, you can't go. They had never done this before. It was like a first-time field trip. And I wanted to go, you know. And so I had that hanging over my head. I just didn't know how I was going to get past writing down all of this, you know, this stuff that I'd done with all these 11 other girls that could possibly read it. And so I wrote that one thing that I didn't want anyone to know in code, and no one could read it. You know, I just put that thing, and I don't really remember what I wrote, but I remember I put it, and found a sponsor. She smoked. That was my one prerequisite because I wanted her to be able. I wanted to smoke during my fifth step, you know, and she went to a lot of meetings, and she always shared, and. So, but she wasn't all that reliable, and we started my fifth step, and I could never get her in touch with her again to finish it. And my counselor was like, my counselor was just another woman in AA, and I hated her. When I first had gotten there, I thought, of all the nice little old ladies, it was just a few little old ladies that worked, I was like, why did I get her? I wanted her to die, or I wanted her husband to get transferred. And I mean, I remember thinking later, God, I am so selfish. Just because I don't want her to be my counselor, I wish she'd die, you know? But she, you know, I was so intimidated by her. She was put together. She was pretty, and she was very well-spoken, and that intimidated me a lot. I remember she told me I was manipulative, and I was 14. I didn't really even know what manipulative was, and I was thinking, no, I'm not. I'm so sure. How dare you call me that, you know? I didn't know that, you know, that I sat around thinking up, how am I going to get drunk? What guy can I con into buying me beer? How can I steal some money to buy some $1.40 malt liquor? You know, things like that. You know, I just didn't even understand what the word meant. I actually turned 15 in the halfway house. But anyway, she and I had become close, and she said, Erica, you know, I don't think that your sponsor is very reliable. And I was like, well, she is reliable, you know? And she said, well, but you need to finish your fifth step, and she hasn't called you back. And I just didn't want to be wrong about her, you know? And so my counselor said, why don't you do the rest of your fifth step with my sponsor? And so I did. And you know, I told two different ladies all those things that I didn't want anyone to know. I never saw either of them again, so it really didn't matter, you know. And I mean, God, you know, those first inventories are just so big and vague. And it's just a list of all these things that you did, you know, resentful at so-and-so, why? Well, he stole from me. Well, you hung around with thieves, you know? Of course he stole from me. And, you know, listening, any of you, you know, listen to First Fifth Steps, they're just so long. And I've heard so many speakers say, you know, oh, and my sponsor, you know, fell asleep and woke up and said, great. All right, step six, you know, and it's just, you know, it's just such a big, vague thing, and the real, it's just getting it out, you know, getting out all that stuff. And there were so many patterns. I mean, there was so much dishonesty and so much stuff that I had done. I mean, it was, they're all the same. The first one, you know, the first one. And I didn't feel good after it. You know, I just felt bad, but I was glad it was done. I think the good feeling that people talk about after your first fifth step is you're just so glad you're not procrastinating on it anymore. And so it was done, and I worked with a woman, a different woman, and we did six and seven, and then it was time for me to go home. I had been in the halfway house for like 8 months, and it was time for me to go back to Lafayette. And my mom picked me up. It was actually weekend of Tri-State. We stayed up here, and my mom was like scoping for people from Lafayette because she wanted me to have a sponsor, man. She wanted me to have a phone number before I went home, and she did. She spotted a woman and grabbed her and said, "This is my daughter, and she's about to go home, but she's sober, and we need phone numbers." And I was so embarrassed, you know. I thought, "Oh my God, just leave me alone!" And this woman, man, thank God for this woman. She got my phone number, and of course, I did not call her. I went back to Lafayette. It was a Sunday. I went to a meeting. And my mom dropped me off, and it was a smoking meeting, so nobody was outside standing around. And so I was in a parking lot, and the door was shut, and if any of you are from Lafayette, it was at the Camel House, and I was like, oh, I'd never gone to a meeting by myself. I had always gone with all the girls from the halfway house, you know? We always walk in together, and, you know, you're in a group, and you feel tough, and you sit down in a group, and so I'm standing there, and I was like, oh, my God. And I thought, okay, if I don't go in tonight, then tomorrow night I'm going to be standing out here going, I don't want to walk in. And then the next day and the next day, and then I'm going to drink, you know. And so I walked in, and there was like two old men. And a few women showed up, not many. And the one that I talked to said, "You're 15. That's so great. My daughter's 15, and she's pregnant. She needs good friends that are sober." And I was like, okay, well, I don't want you to be my sponsor. and I went back to different meetings, and I went actually back to high school the very next day. And it's so funny because I was ready to go back. I had quit going. I hadn't actually dropped out. I just quit showing up. And since I was on homebound when I was in treatment, I made straight A's, and it salvaged my high school experience, you know. So I got to stay in. And when I left, I didn't really have many friends that were in school. Most of them had dropped out. And so all my friends that were in high school wanted me to stop drinking so bad, and I thought, they are going to be so grateful. And then I sobered up. And I remember I went, you know, I mean, if you can just imagine high school, I'm so grateful I'm not in it anymore and never have to be again. I went to high school and I saw a friend, and he was, you know, a good person, and I was like, hey, I'm back. And I had been gone for almost an entire year. I'd been gone for 10 months. And he said, "Erica, where'd you go?" And I said, "I went to treatment. I've been gone since last year." And he said, I thought you moved. I didn't know where you went. I didn't even know you were gone, blah, 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 blah." And I thought, nobody gives a shit that I'm sober, you know? They didn't even know. You know, they didn't even know I was gone. And also, in the year that I had been away from high school, the drug revolution had taken place, and my friends that were these good kids that wanted me not to drink were partying, you know, South Louisiana. They were partying all the time. So I went through this thing where I don't fit in high school, and I don't fit in AA. You know, my friends in AA were over 18. They could go shoot pool. They could go hear bands. And I was 15, and I couldn't do that. But I didn't want to hang out with the people that went to high school that were partying. And if you are sober and you're in high school, I just feel for you. It is so, I mean, it is just so hard. It was. I mean, prom and, you know, all that stuff. I went to prom and I was glad I went, but God, it sucked. You know, I just went because I had made it there and I hadn't dropped out. You know, that was the reason I went. And I remember the year that I got to go, the beginning of the school year, I started looking for a dress, had no date, had no boyfriend. And the thing's not until the end of the year. And I started telling my sponsor, I need a date. I need a date. I need a date for months and months and months. And she said, take my husband. I don't care what you do, you know. Eventually she said, you know what? Maybe you're not supposed to go to prom. Maybe you're supposed to help another alcoholic that night. And I thought, no, no, that's not possible, you know. This is my high school prom. Let me backtrack a little bit. I got back, and I went to a meeting every single night, but I never took any offers to go out for coffee. And I found a sponsor. The third day I was home, I asked this woman to be my sponsor, and she had been sober a long time, and she shared in the meeting. That's why I picked her. That's all I really knew, you know. And so, we never really got together. I called her, I didn't call her every day, but I did call her, and she wasn't working the steps, you know. So she wasn't obviously getting me into the steps, and I didn't really know any better, and I had just gotten another sponsor. But what happened before that was that woman from Tri-State called me and said, there's a young people's Lacey Paul committee meeting. And so you need to go, and it's on Sunday afternoon, show up. So I go, and there's like 8 guys, and you know, I was so nervous, and she sent this woman to meet me who became my sponsor, and she was loud and funny, and her name is Stacy H, and she lives in Austin now, and she was just like, hey girl, what you doing? You know, and she brought me home, and it was really, man, it was a God thing. She lived really close to me, and I didn't drive because I was in treatment, drink, driver's ed. And so she lived like 3 blocks from me, and so she could pick me up every night, you know. She brought me to a step study, went to this woman's step study, and I was so timid and so afraid, and all these women knew what they were talking about, you know, and I didn't. All I did was read when it came to my turn, and then I just kept my mouth shut, and she's a woman who took me to a lot of conventions, and she was just a lot of fun. And she got me involved in a step study. And then she moved, and so I found another woman that was in the step study. She stayed my sponsor for a long time. She's the one who had the husband who she offered for me to take to prom. But I was more handy than that. I found a nice young guy in treatment who I waited for him to get out of treatment. I don't think he was out when I asked him. He was in the 3/4 way house. That's where he was. And waited till he had 9 months, you know, thought that was good enough. Asked him to prom, and he said yes, and we went to prom. And, you know, he was young, didn't want to be sober. I didn't know that. And I thought, you know, I thought it had to work. So I followed him to North Carolina, dated him for 2 years, and let's see, I was 17 when I met him. And I mean, he was never sober. Even though I watched him pick up a year chip, he was never sober that whole time, and I didn't know. I thought it was, you know, match made in heaven. And you know, I just wish all of you could have been here this morning. The things that Jennifer said, I want to take the tape to one of my friends, Janet's tape. Sorry, Janet. She said, you know, not to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And man, my friends didn't want me to date this guy. You know, they just begged and begged and begged. Don't do it. Don't do it. You're moving 1,000 miles away. I graduated, and he was from North Carolina. He was moving back there, and I thought, oh, don't want to live in this town anymore. I want to, you know, broaden my horizons. He moved, and I talked to him, and a month later, I put everything that would fit in my car, and my mom and I drove up there, and she's crying, and, oh, my God, this is such a bad idea. And, you know, I knew it was a bad idea. I prayed, God, if I'm not supposed to go, please put a tree in the road. Put, you know, have something block my way. And, you know, had that happened, I realized later, had that happened, I would have gone around it and thought, woo, you know, I would not have heeded to the sign. But wait, before that, I got involved with Wake Call, and, Chris Hines, who's not here anymore, a lot of you know him, was involved, and he was still sober, and strong sobriety with the host committee of Lacey Paul that year. It was really, really cool. I got a home group. I got involved. I got the job that nobody else wanted, you know? Like, I was too unknowledgeable about the service commitments, and so nobody would volunteer, and then someone would say, well, Erica, you don't have a commitment, and so I'd be like, okay. And so that's how I got the service commitment I got, which was the treatment and corrections, which was so unorganized and hadn't had anybody involved in it. I got the district position because nobody wanted to do it, you know? And our detox, I mean, it's just now, if you just knew how treatment and corrections, it is amazing in Lafayette right now. The involvement is just awesome. But, God, when I was there, it was bad. And I just had no idea. I was like, okay, I'll do it. Sure, you know. Very easy to persuade. I've done a lot of work on that, you know, since then. I mean, I've had to become much more assertive. But anyway, so I did that and continued to be in step study, started sponsoring people, made lots and lots and lots of bad decisions when it came to sponsoring people. I'm sure I've been the arbiter of many people's sex conduct. I went through a time from like 2 to 4 years where I just thought I have all of the answers. And if you don't think so, I'll tell you. And I was the type of person that would, like, you know, pull people aside after the meeting and say, well, don't you think whatever, whatever about what you're doing? And, you know, I think it's this way, and I think you need to take a look at that. And, no, I'm not your sponsor, but I have all the answers, and here they are. And, you know, it's just, I mean, everyone goes through it, hopefully, at least, so you can be understanding of the other people when they're going through it, you know, because now if I know someone is going through that, I just love them and know that if they just keep working the steps, it won't be that way in a few years, you know. So I moved to North Carolina, and we did not last. We made it total, like, 4 months. But I had started school there, so I was in the middle of the semester. And, so I didn't want to leave, and it was kind of slow going. When I got up there, there weren't a whole lot of young people, but I met the people that were involved with Nikki Paul, and so they got the conference in Raleigh that year, which was where I was living, and so, I mean, if you just show up in AA, you have Insta friends, you know? I was showed up at the meetings, and got involved in that convention, but part of that, I showed up at these meetings and kind of snuck out afterward because I was nervous. And finally, my boyfriend said, you got to get some friends, you know. I would sit at home and wait for him to come home and want to hang out with him. And really, we honestly didn't have much of a friendship the whole time that we were dating. We were just cramping each other, and the relationship was ending. So I showed up at this coffee shop that I knew people in the program went to, asked if I could sit down, And they said, you know, sure, go ahead, sit down. No one asked who I was, where was I from, how old was I, why was I here, none of that. And so I was kind of baffled, you know, like, you're supposed to want to know who I am, and I'm the new person. And I just kept showing up, and eventually, you know, people did ask, and I got to know lots of the AA community there, and I ended up staying for 2 years, and it was really awesome, and I loved living up there. My grandmother passed away. I had a free house to live in Lafayette, and had decided that I wanted to go to college for architecture, and so, and USL or ULL has a really awesome architecture program. So after being up there 2 years, the opportunity arose for me to come home, and the thing was, you know, at this point when I was making a decision about moving 1,000 miles away, the decision was, man, I have two really cool places to live. You know, it wasn't about a relationship. It wasn't, you know, the motives were honest this time. And the move to North Carolina worked out for the best only because I worked the steps. That's the only reason. You know, I continued to go to meetings, and I continued to work the steps, and I had a sponsor. When I got up there, showed up, picked a home group, showed up at the business meeting, happened to be election night, and somebody says, you want to do treatment and correction? And, God, you know, still so gullible, like, okay. But it was very organized up there, very organized. You show up, you get your meetings, you bring a group of them, that's it. Very, very organized. So I had some, like, it was much harder to make the decision that time, you know, because I loved North Carolina. I really changed because I didn't have my family around, and you know, when you live in the same town as your family, it's much easier for me to act like I did when I was a child. You know, they're around. I don't have to do as much for myself. And I think had I not moved away, I wouldn't have learned how to really just really take care of myself on my own. And the biggest thing that I got out of that is more dependence on God, because when I was there, it was me by myself. And so when I was there, I had to stay on people's sofas, have roommates. It took a long time before I actually got my first little itty-bitty hole-in-the-wall apartment and no furniture. I mean, I went up there with the clothes that would fit in my car. Someone gave me a sofa, gave me a washer and dryer, gave me a bed, gave me a dresser. You know, it was a house that love built. And I remember being in that apartment thinking, this is the best possible place I could ever live. You know, this is so awesome. God, there's so much to talk about in sobriety. I came back down here. I had a roommate for a year and a half. Learned how to live with another person. We're still friends, you know. We still love each other. It was actually a person from North Carolina, this great girl, and it came time for me to live alone, you know, and it was time for her to experience the growing up part, you know, and so I through working the steps and lots of support of my sponsor, you know, went through that, the process of us parting ways and staying friends and doing it responsibly and acting like adults. It was really, really cool. In that time, I mean, I had to learn how to confront different things. You know, it's like when you live together, oh, it's just so easy to not practice these principles in our homes, you know. And, man, I had a lot of looking at myself and sitting down to say, I think that we need to talk about cleaning the house. And it was like, oh, I don't want to do this. Something so little, I didn't want to do it. You know, it's so scary. I'm almost done. I just have real quick, I want to talk about some amends. The first time that I made my amends list, there were two people on it, and I didn't know how to get in touch with them. And I was willing, but I just had no idea how to get in touch with them. And within like the 2 weeks of writing my amends list, I came home, and there was a odd-looking car in the driveway with Ohio plates on it, and it was one of the girls on my amends list that was down visiting, and she was there, and I got to make amends to her, and it was like, oh, wow, God, you know, that is, like, I know you're up there now, you know, I really, like, I was blown away. And then sometime within 2 weeks after making the list, this girl called me that was in the program and said, my sister just got out of treatment. She doesn't know anybody. Can you bring her to a meeting? And it was the girl, the other girl on the list that I didn't know how to get in touch with. And there she was. I didn't know they were sisters. And I got to make amends to her, too. And, I mean, I actually heard a speaker tell a similar story. Actually, I think it might have been someone, I think it was Casey, tell a similar story. And I'm just like, you know, wow, if we are willing to just do the right thing, if we are willing to clean up the past, we are given the options to do it. And also about amends, last year I had this resentment that I thought was going to kill me. I didn't want to drink, but I know that I'm in this book, and it says that if we, you know, that anger is poison for us, and it's a luxury that we don't have, and that if I don't do something about it, I will die or I will drink. And I knew that if I didn't do something about that resentment, I wasn't going to stay sober. And I don't know what happened. I mean, I've talked about it, and I have written about it, and finally I made amends to this girl, and it went away. Like, it completely went away. She was still the same. She's still the same. It completely went away. I had two experiences like that, one with a family member and one with another woman. And it was, I mean, when I tell you, I just couldn't see where I was wrong, you know. I could not find fault in myself. And I just thought, you know, it's this person. She's sick. And when I finally just admitted my own faults and made amends for them, the resentment went away. And I wanted to be free from it, you know. There's so much more I could talk about, sponsorship and things like that, but I don't want to bore you guys, and I'm sure you're ready to smoke, which I don't do anymore. 5 months now, I'm smoke-free. So anyway, I'm so grateful that I got to be one of the speakers here at Rosie Paul, and thank you guys for all the hard work you've done, and I love you guys very much, and that's it.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. Thank you.